host, Jace. This is episode 480. It's New Comics Wednesday for August 29th, 2018. I'm going to be talking about a few of the books that are going to be on stands today, as well as some other titles out today that you should be on the lookout for or you might want to know about. It is the fifth Wednesday of the month, so that's always a little weird when we have five Wednesdays in the same month. Oftentimes what happens is there just aren't as many main titles. A lot of times the publishers will take advantage of the extra Wednesday to put out things like annuals or to get caught up on books that are a little further behind. So just be aware there's not quite as many titles out, especially from DC. They seem to be the one that on these fifth Wednesday months really put out, like I said, annuals or other titles that are a little late. They don't really put out a lot of the regular issues. So it's especially strange when you have books that, you know, come out twice a month. So you're expecting one every other week and, you know, might not happen this week. So let me go ahead and dive right in. The first book I'm going to talk about is actually my book of the month, or book of the week, rather. It's The Beyonders, number one, from Aftershock, written by Paul Jenkins with art by Wesley St. Clair. I talked to Paul about this book way back in, I think it was June, at the Comic-Con Revolution in Ontario, California, and he talked about the fact that it's a kid who fancies himself a code breaker, a cipher, and he knows a lot about conspiracy theories and ancient mysteries of the world. And the story starts off and he's actually narrating it, and he's talking about all these different mysteries of the ancient world and of the past, and, you know, some conspiracies and things people think, and they seem relatively unrelated, but you kind of get the feeling that in his mind they're all related. And he seems to live a pretty normal existence in Alaska. You know, he goes to high school, he's about to graduate, he lives with his aunt and uncle, and from all appearances his life's, as I said, pretty normal. But, you know, as they say, appearances can be deceiving. And it turns out that he may know a lot more than he realizes. And it may be that the things that he knows and suspects are in fact true. And if that's the case, he may have put himself in a lot of danger by believing these things and by talking online to people about them. So that's kind of where the first issue goes. It's very intriguing, and I love kind of the world that Paul Jenkins is building. I love the lighthearted tone that he keeps throughout the book, despite the fact that you do feel like there are stakes, right? There are, especially for our main character, there are consequences for his actions. So, the main character's name is Jake. He has a little corgi dog that I'm sure is going to be a fan favorite, and even has a little eye patch on it. It looks really cute, actually. And as I said, he lives with his aunt and uncle. He goes to high school, and he has this hobby. And he believes there are conspiracies and secrets, and he thinks can be the one to solve them. So it's a big giant treasure hunt, and they actually put a treasure hunt in the book. Can you crack the code? We see from a note from Paul Jenkins dated 2018. There's a lot of little clues in the book, and if you can figure it out, you can assemble the clues, and there's going to be a lot of prizes to be handed out. So you may want to pay attention. I kind of looked through it myself. I'm definitely going to have to study it a little more. I don't know the answer at this point, but I think it's a really cool idea. And the reason I picked this for my book of the week is it's just so fun and different. something I haven't read anything like this in a while, right? It's just a very fun adventure type story. Yeah, the little twist isn't the most original, but again, I feel like Jenkins did a great job of making the characters compelling. I certainly want to know what happens next. I can't wait for issue two. And the art by Wesley St. Clair was very well done as well. He did a great job of capturing kind of that feel and tone of us kind of looking at this world through Jake's eyes. And I feel like he did a really great job of moving the camera around in the panels. The panel angles they shift around quite a bit, and it's really masterful storytelling. Great transitions from panel to panel, great color work, especially in the flashbacks. We definitely get a different feel. So all in all, really strong debut. Man, I feel like Paul Jenkins is just, anytime he does a title over at Aftershock, he just absolutely knocks it out of the park. I mean, he wrote my favorite title over there to date, which is Replica. Still waiting for the return of that, but this will definitely tide me over because it's great. I love the start of this series, and do not sleep on this. Be sure you go out there and pick it up. Being that it's Aftershock, it's a bit of a smaller publisher, so you really have to let your retailers know if you're interested in these books, because oftentimes if you don't, they're pretty hard to find. You can't just, you know, track them down anywhere, because oftentimes if they haven't been pre-ordered, your retailer's not ordering any copies of them at all. So do yourself a favor, let your retailers know that you want these books from Aftershock. Otherwise, like I said, you may have a hard time tracking them down. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is also from Aftershock. It's A Walk Through Hell, number 4, from writer Garth Ennis. We've got art by Goran Suzuka and colors by Eve Zvorchina. So as I said, this is issue 4 of A Walk Through Hell. And it's interesting. This book has been very compelling and very good from Garth Ennis. It is a return to horror for him, but the horror here is very subtle. It's not in your face. We have seen some pretty shocking images so far in a few of the issues. I think specifically issues 2 and 3, and had a really kind of melodramatic page in issue 1 toward the end that was kind of like a holy crap page. In this issue, we don't really get any scenes where we're like shocked or surprised. It's not, this one definitely doesn't read like a horror book at all. It's more like just character drama. But I have a feeling that's just leading us to the end, right? To finding out a lot of answers to our questions, because that's been the thing so far that's been, I don't want to say frustrating, but it's interesting the way that Ennis has structured this story, because we are finding ourselves with a lot more questions than we have answers. And especially considering the fact that he's chosen to tell the story in a non-linear way, I won't say that it's confusing, but it makes it so we certainly don't have the whole picture yet. Like, not only do we not know what's behind this walk through hell that these FBI agents are taking, we don't know really at this point what's behind the supernatural occurrence. We don't know what the FBI agents did. We clearly know they did something wrong. They're feeling guilty about something. And we also don't have a clear picture of like who the antagonist is at this point. So it's one of those things where as the drama and the tension is being ramped up, we can't help but wonder what the missing pieces are, right? Like what are the parts of the puzzle that the characters know that we don't? And then what are the parts of the puzzle that the characters don't know and we don't know. So there's kind of multiple layers here. And for my money, there's not really anybody out there who writes character interaction better than Garth Ennis. You know, I've said a lot of times on the podcast, I'm not really a horror guy. I guess I'm kind of coming around to that because I do find myself reading more and more quote unquote horror books these days, like Black Eyed Kids, for example, or A Walk Through Hell. But one of the first kind of horror titles that I ever read was Crossed from Garth Ennis. And it's very much for mature readers. It's very graphic. It's very violent. I remember like looking at it and reading the first few issues and thinking, man, this is like brutal. I don't know if I really want to be putting this kind of stuff in my head, right? Like there was a time, and I felt this way about The Boys too, also by Garth Ennis, the first time I read it, because it's so graphic and so bloody. And it's, to me, it's not what superhero comics and thus comics are supposed to be about, because that's when I read The Boys, I pretty much exclusively read superhero comics. But The Boys and some other titles showed me that, hey, you know, there's more to comics than just superheroes. And then when I was like, what's this about Cross? Like, what's this buzz about? Let me go ahead and read it. And I read the first few issues and I'm like, man, I really don't know that I want to be reading this, because again, it's so, it's just so raw and intense and graphic and violent. And I was like, man, do I really want to be putting this in my head? But the thing that kept me coming back was the characters. He made the characters so compelling that I found myself sucked in. I feel the same way about A Walk Through Hell, and I think this is going to read so amazing as one long narrative where you can read like the whole story in one sitting. It'll really make that that non-linear style of storytelling that he's using, it'll make it that much more impactful. I don't think that it necessarily works as well doing it in, you know, monthly issues, just because it is a book where you really need to kind of be invested and have that emotional connection. But when you read as many books as I do, yeah, I vaguely recall what happened. You know, I get the broad strokes of what's happened in the story so far, but I don't think it is impactful as if I were to, you know, read all the issues one right after another, or read it in trade. I think it's going to read better that way, but it's definitely worth picking up. It's another Aftershock title. It's Garth Ennis doing what he does best. And, you know, that's writing really compelling characters. And as I said, I think Mike Martz, when we had him on the show a while back to talk about this title, said it himself, that this is more subtle horror rather than the in-your-face, super gory, bloody kind of stuff that Garth has done in the past. And in that way, it's almost more terrifying, right? Because it's more about the emotionality of the story and the tension of the story rather than kind of the shock and awe of these graphic images or impactful images. Right, let me talk about Scarlet next. So this is from writer Brian Edward Hill with art by Alex Malev, and it's from the Jinx World imprint, which is basically Bendis's creator-owned imprint over at DC. So far, we've gotten Pearl from that imprint, which is a new creator-owned concept that Bendis is trying over there. And now this one is a property that he and Malev have created stories for before. And I think it was probably for the Icon imprint, which was kind of his creator-owned imprint over at Marvel. So I read this, and again, it's the next chapter in the story of Scarlet, who is apparently a woman who has led a revolt or a rebellion in the United States in Portland, apparently. So I think as a new reader coming into this, it's not really confusing per se. Like, you can kind of understand, okay, apparently Scarlet got the raw end of the deal from some corrupt cops. Her boyfriend or fiance, somebody that she really cared about, got killed. And she took the law into her own hands. And now Portland's kind of separate from the rest of the world. So it's not the most original concept. You can get the gist of what's going on by reading this. But I still think if you're like me and you haven't read any Scarlet previous to this, you're not going to get as much out of it as somebody who's read the story up to this point. So for me, just based on the strength of this one issue, I don't know that I would come back. If I compare it to the book I was just talking about, A Walk Through Hell, the characters here are not that compelling. There's nothing about Scarlet or any of the other characters that we're introduced to in this issue that is compelling enough to say, okay, I'm gonna check back in and see what happens next. I really found myself not really caring that much. There's not that much that happens in this issue. It is kind of a setup issue. It is Scarlet really giving us like an info dump to some extent, but she's kind of explaining what's happened so far in her world, but we don't get to know about her, right? It's all set up. We're not really understanding her, you know, her motivations or why she's doing what she's doing, why she's kind of pitted herself against the government. Like if we knew any of that, if we understood her motivations a little better, maybe that's where some of the feeling that we need to read the story, you know, going forward to find out what happens, maybe that kind of feeling would be there. Cause it's, for me, it's just not. So I would say that it was interesting enough and I'm curious enough that I would, like, if someone were to give me the first part of the story, right, the first volume, or, you know, whether it's a trade or whatever, and said, hey, you know, here, check this out, then I could see myself, if that part of the story was good and made sense to me, then I could see myself saying, okay, yeah, now I know what this new Scarlet number one is about. I get a lot more out of it, and I'm ready to jump on board with issue two. But as it stands, just reading this as a standalone without having read any of the previous Scarlet story, yeah, for me it just fell a little bit flat. So if I do get a chance to check out the previous Scarlet title, I imagine it's probably available on Comixology or something. So I may look for it digitally at some point. You know, it's not like I don't have a giant stack of books to read, but if I do get a chance to check it out and decide it makes this new volume of Scarlet worth reading, I'll definitely let you guys know. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Isola number 5. I've said many a time on the podcast that this is the most beautiful book out there on stands today, and I've seen nothing in this fifth issue to make me change my mind. The story is by Brendan Fletcher and Carl Kershaw, and we have art by Carl Kershaw and M. Sassy K. I think that's how you say the name, because it's literally M, the word sassy, and then K, but it's all together. So it could be like Masasic. I'm not sure. So apologies if I'm butchering that. So what Fletcher and Kershaw have done here as far as story and world building is create this fantasy world that's, again, to use that word, super compelling. You can't help but be pulled in by kind of the strange creatures and the apparent magic of the world. Plus, it's a very tragic story with interesting characters, right? So for those of you who haven't been following along, the title stars kind of the captain of the Queen's Guard. She's queen of this realm, and she's cursed by somebody and turned into a tiger. And it's clear that this captain of her guard cares for the queen very much, and the queen in turn cares for her very much. Their relationship is much more than just, you know, a queen and her guard, you know, or a queen and one of her subjects. It's clear and never more clear than in issue 5 that these two women share a very strong bond, and their feelings for each other go much farther than just, you know, loyal subject and ruler. It may even be romantic feelings. So that's a very good motivation, and motivation that, as a reader, I can understand very well why Rook, the soldier, the guard of the Queen's, is so committed and so determined to find a cure for the Queen's condition, to return her to her human form, to protect her in any situation. And likewise, we've seen the Queen put herself in harm's way, in this tiger form, put herself in harm's way to prevent Rook from being hurt in the past. And now in this issue, in issue 5, the Queen, Olwen, is kind of paying for that sacrifice that she made. So again, it's character first and really compelling characters. And you know, I've talked about this a lot recently on the podcast about how if you, as a storyteller and as a writer, if you build your world correctly and you make it interesting and you've got a really good hook, right? A really great central kind of theme or idea to your story, and then you inhabit that story, you tell that story with interesting and compelling characters, and then you build a setting as far as the world goes well enough that it becomes a character in its own right and is also interesting and compelling, then you really have the recipe for a great comic, right? And that's what we have here with Isola. Now, Isola takes it one step further from being a great comic to being an outstanding comic because of the art. The artwork, from the line work to the page layouts, the panel layouts, the colors, everything. It's absolutely top-notch. It's simply the most beautiful book out there on stands today. You know, the visuals are fantastic, especially, and I think a lot of it has to do with the color work and the way the color choices aren't the most obvious ones, but the brightness of them and kind of the way they're able to make these colors jump off the page and make the magic look, you know, like it's glowing. It gives it very much a supernatural feel, and it helps to establish mood extremely well in the story. So this issue 5 is the last issue of the first volume, so there will be a trade coming out soon. I don't know if you'll be able to find any copies of the early issues if you want to go back and try to collect it in singles, because there was a lot of buzz about this book, and I'm pretty sure it sold out, at least the first couple of issues. I think they did a second print, though, of issue 1, so you may be able to find that. But as it stands, I'm sure you'll be able to get the trade coming up here within the next few months. And again, the series is supposed to return in 2019, but you definitely want to be caught up before the series returns, because the only bad thing about issue 5 was when I did read that at the end, that Isola will continue in January, or will return in January 2019. It's like, man, I got to go 3-4 months before I get the next issue. That kind of stinks, but that'll probably just give me time to, I'll probably go back and reread 1 through 5 at least once or twice more, because the book has been incredible. Every once in a while, there's titles that come out where when the new issue comes out, I find myself compelled to go back and read like all the previous issues. And this is, that happened with Morning Glories. It's the last title I can remember it happening with, and which is, you know, a really great title from Nick Spencer and Joe Eisma that I dearly miss. But Isola is that as well. So issue 1 came out, I read it, I was blown away. Issue 2 came out, I went back and I read issue one and then issue two. And then when issue three came out, I went back and I read issue one and two over and then three. Because there's just so much to look at. There's so much to see. There's not a lot of dialogue. I've talked about that before when I've talked about this book. And it just goes to show just how great a job that the artists are doing in telling the story. The fact that you don't need a lot of words. You don't need a lot of dialogue boxes or exposition boxes. So much of the story is told visually, and those visuals are so stunning. So I really can't recommend Isola strongly enough. It's without a doubt the most beautiful comic out there right now, and a really, really compelling story, and I can't wait to see where it goes from here. A lot of emotionality too, which you don't, at least personally, I don't always expect from a fantasy comic, because sometimes it's hard to relate, right, when you're talking about fairies and gnomes and dwarves or what have you. Sometimes you can find it hard to relate because those aren't creatures that we're used to encountering in our everyday lives. At least I hope you guys aren't used to encountering them. So anyway, let me talk about the next book on my list. It's Cyberforce number 5 from writers Matt Hawkins and Brian Edward Hill, with art by Attilio Rojo. So in Cyberforce 5, we get introduced to another member of this new Cyberforce that's kind of a reimagining of one of the previous Cyberforce characters. And this time it's Ripclaw. We don't get a lot of background. We don't get a lot of understanding of where he's coming from or who he is or how he's going to play into the larger story of Cyberforce. But what we do get is a lot of really great art, a lot of action, and we get a little bit of insight into who Ripclaw is. He's not just a kind of a point and shoot weapon. He's much more, for lack of a better word, I'm going to say human than that, right? I mean, he has reasons that he does what he does. And although we don't necessarily understand his motivations yet, we see that he is somebody who has honor, who has integrity, and has a belief in the greater good. And so all those things are interesting. But again, how it plays into the larger Cyberforce story, it remains to be seen. So I know that one of the themes that Brian Edward Hill wants to explore in this book, and he talked about this when he was on the podcast, is that idea of transhumanism, right? Like, how far can you go with replacing yourself with, you know, technology and still be human? And I have a feeling that that may be part of what drives Ripclaw. And for him, I think it goes even one step further. It's also not just about how much technology can you replace, how much of your body can be replaced by machine and computer and what have you, and still retain your humanity. It seems like for Ripclaw, it's also about your actions, right? Like, how many terrible things can you do and still be a good person, so to speak? You know, if you're out there killing people, but you're doing it for the right reasons, how long can you keep that up before you really have lost your soul, before you really are just a killing machine? So I can definitely see Hill and Hawkins wanting to explore that more. But I have to say, this isn't one of my favorite issues just because it is so focused on Ripclaw. We don't get a lot of forward momentum with some of the other characters that I'm very curious about, especially Velocity. So, but as far as the artwork on the book, absolutely spectacularly done by Attilio Rojo. He has been amazing. His art on this title has been spectacular from day one, especially the action scenes and the explosions. Just incredible work. I can't stress enough how beautiful this book is, both from a line art standpoint and also from the color work. The color work is done extremely well. also, and I hope Attilio Rojo stays on this title for a long time, but he's so good. And, you know, I've seen it before with Top Cow artists where Marvel or DC come in and poach them and get them working on Superman or Spider-Man or what have you. So I hope that doesn't happen with Rojo. I hope he stays on this book a really long time because to me, this is how these Cyberforce characters should look. This is how I'm picturing them in my mind. Kind of these updated versions that Rojo is putting on the page, and just spectacular. So it should be pretty easy to get caught up on Cyberforce if you're not. As I said, this is only issue number 5, and I think all 5 issues should probably be available at your local comic shop. So really recommend you going in and checking them out. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about is from IDW. It's House Amok, written by Christopher Sabella with art by Sean McManus. This is a really weird book. I guess you would call it horror. And it deals with the concept of folie à deux, which is a French term meaning madness for two, or shared psychosis, right? So the presence of same or similar delusional ideas in two persons closely related with one another. So in this first issue, we meet this family who are out on a summer vacation. And apparently that summer vacation includes capturing people that, from what I can gather, they think are like possessed or something like that. In a way, it kind of reminded me of Frailty. If you guys are familiar with that movie with Powers Booth and Matthew McConaughey and Bill Paxton, really, really great movie. So this family that's out on this vacation, it's twin girls, an older brother, and a mother and a father. And clearly they believe some kind of conspiracy, something or other. And I don't know if it's the parents that have bought into this because they have issues and they've kind of brainwashed it, their kids into thinking it. Or, I mean, it is a comic, so maybe this stuff really is happening. It's not 100% clear, but we're getting the story through the eyes of one of the young children in the family, one of the twin girls, and she's kind of narrating for us. And I love the family dynamic. I love how close they are as a family. And I love the sibling rivalry and the bickering that all rang very true. And, you know, kind of like Beyonders, the first title I talked about, there's clearly some conspiracy theory kind of background stuff going on here. And that seems to be the launching point for Sabella to tell his story. So I think that makes for a good starting point. And what's interesting as a reader looking into it, as I said, it's a comic. So maybe what this family believes is actually true, right? Maybe there are aliens. Maybe there is some kind of secret invasion or whatever. Again, we don't understand their motivations completely at this point. But I love the relationship with the little girls. I love that it's being narrated through the eyes of or the voice of one of the little girls, and character work is done well enough that I definitely will check in with House Amok number 2, if only to try to have a better understanding of, so what exactly do these people believe, and what exactly have they been up to, and it's an interesting story from the point of looking at it as a psychology major, and seeing the shared psychosis of this family who are a close-knit family and have these strange beliefs, right? And again, part of the reason that it reminds me of that movie Frailty is because in that movie, spoilers if you haven't seen it, we don't – even when the movie's over, you don't really ever get a straight answer of whether or not the quote-unquote monsters or demons in that movie were real or if it was just all imagined. And so I'm curious to know if we're going to get a concrete answer for Sabella about that in this series, or if he's going to walk that tightrope the whole time and ultimately leave it up to us readers to decide. if we believe that the conspiracy theories and, you know, these secret hidden antagonists really existed, or if it's all in the mind of this family sharing some kind of psychosis. The artwork by Sean McManus is almost diametrically opposed to the type of story that's being told here. It's very cartoon-like. It's very almost like Sunday morning comic strip. And when you're dealing with, you know, cutting people open and, you know, out hunting people that you think are possessed and everything, it's, you don't really want that Charlie Brown, Charles Schultz kind of feel with the art, but, for some reason it works. And maybe it is that juxtaposition, that makes it work so well. One of the things I do know that helps make it work is the fact that we are getting the story kind of fed to us through the words of one of these little girls. And so the fact that they're kind of the main character and the narrator, you know, you always associate a certain level of naivete and innocence to, you know, a girl this age. And the artwork definitely kind of suits that. It's more, you know, more of an animation style, more of a cartoon style, very clean lines. And the colors are relatively bright as well. So it fits with the narrative that's being told, the way we're learning about the story. It doesn't necessarily fit with the story itself, which is a great kind of way to set a certain tone and mood in the book. Try to keep it fun to some extent. So I was really impressed. It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I think I just heard Christopher Sabella and horror, and I thought it was going to be kind of in your face, gory, kind of there's a giant monster going around like killing people and slicing them open and throwing their entrails all over the page. And I don't know why I thought that in particular. Maybe because I know what an incredible writer Sabella is, and how if he says horror, then I'm going to think, you know, like straight up classic horror, almost like a gore fest kind of thing. And it's not that at all. So it's a really great title. Again, it's from IDW and their Black Crown label, which is the kind of the imprint that Shelley Bond, former, senior editor over at Vertigo for DC. It's her imprint that she's running over there. So definitely recommend it. I picked it up just based on the fact that it was Christopher Sabella writing it, and I tend to enjoy his work. So I do recommend that as well. So let me do a quick rundown of other titles you might want to be on the lookout for today. I mentioned two of the three Aftershock titles that are coming out today already, Beyonders and Walk Through Hell. We also have Brothers Dracul number 5 from Cullen Bunn. Over at DC, we've got Batgirl 26, Batgirl Annual 2. We've also got a Nightwing Annual and a Silencer Annual. I already talked in detail about Scarlet number 1 of 5. There's also several of the DC characters teamed up with Warner Brothers characters. So we've got a Catwoman, Tweety, and Sylvester. And I'm pretty sure that one was written by Gail Simone. We've got a Harley Quinn Gossamer special. That one's written by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor. We've got a Joker and Daffy special and a Lex Luthor and Porky Pig special. So if you're a fan of those crossovers, I definitely would suggest picking those up. They all have really great creative teams. I myself am going to probably read all of them, but the one I'm probably looking forward to checking out the most is the Lex Luthor Porky Pig special, because it's got Brad Walker art, which I just love Brad's art. So over at IDW, we've got the latest issue of G.I. Joe, number 255 from Larry Hama. At Image, in addition to Cyberforce and Isola number 5, we've got New World number 2 of 5, and we've got Wayward number 28 from Jim Zub. And Wayward's actually winding down. I think it ends with issue 30, so be on the lookout for that. At Marvel, we have a Daredevil Annual number 1, and we also have a, let's see, where is it? We also have a Hunt for Wolverine Dead Ends number one, which wraps up that Hunt for Wolverine storyline, which will then lead into the Return of Wolverine event by Charles Soule and Steve McNiven. Also, Extermination number two, with those beautiful Mark Brooks covers, supposedly going to resolve one way or another the original five X-Men being in our world. So we've got to get that resolved in what I think will be a kind of a cleanup of the Marvel Universe. We've also got Venom First Host number one, as well as a Web of Venom Venom, which is an, yeah, again, I'm just not sure how this works, but it's somehow it's a Vietnam story starring Venom. So I guess they're retconning Venom back into previous pasts of the Marvel Universe, which really doesn't make sense to me, but whatever. And finally, we have Harbinger Wars 2, number 4, which wraps up that miniseries over at Valiant, as well as Exo Man of War, number 18. So, again, not as many books as there usually are, especially from DC. A lot of specials, a lot of annuals, being that it's a fifth Wednesday of the month. So, once again, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, be sure to check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.